Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. Over 5 million Americans are living with this disease that has devastating effects on patients and their families. Well, tonight on Health Matters, we will be discussing Alzheimer's and its treatment. I'm Kermit Poling, and we're joined in the studio this evening by psychiatrist Dr. Gary Booker. Also, Debbie Hayes, who's the Associate Director of the Louisiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and Dr. Christine Wright, who is an occupational therapist with LSU Health, who specializes in training medical personnel and families on how to care for those with Alzheimer's. As always, your questions are welcome at 800-552-8502. So good evening to all of you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to start, if you don't mind, with you, Debbie, because I know that of course, not only are you associated with the Alzheimer's Association, but you know what it's like to have a family member who's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Can you share some of your personal experience with the disease?
Oh, certainly. And thanks for having me tonight. Like you said, my dad was diagnosed probably about 8 years ago with Alzheimer's disease. And at the time, we didn't really know a whole lot about the disease. We just saw that things were changing for him, and he was quite stressed about, you know, things that were happening and why they were happening. But that was a long time ago. Now he's currently in a facility. He hasn't, I don't think, recognized me for probably 3 or 4 months. So, you know, he's never going to call my name again. He's never going to recognize me again, it seems. Some days are better than others now, but it's definitely a struggle. It's definitely a journey that folks go on once they get that diagnosis. And Dad remained pretty stable for quite some time, but this last year has he's taken a downturn, and he now, like I said, lives in a facility.
Can one of you talk a little bit about the difference between Alzheimer's and some of the other diseases that are typically associated with older age, things like Parkinson's and all of that? What differentiates it? What's going on in Alzheimer's?
With Alzheimer's, this Dr. Booker. With Alzheimer's, it starts off with short-term memory, and whereas with Parkinson's, it's mainly a motor problem. They have trouble walking. They have tremor, and there is some Parkinson's patients that also develop dementia. But I think to kind of rephrase your question, what are the different types of dementias? And Alzheimer's is probably the most common type of dementia, followed by stroke dementia. And there's probably 30 or 40 other types of dementias that when a patient comes in with dementia, you try to put them in, diagnostic-wise, you try to put them in the right category. And to some degree, the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is made by excluding some of the other diagnoses. For example, if you're trying to exclude stroke dementia, a CAT scan of the brain would kind of tell you how many strokes they had, and if they had a lot of big strokes, you would think, well, this is probably infarction dementia or vascular dementia versus Alzheimer's dementia. There's probably there's many different types of dementia, but Alzheimer's and stroke dementia are the two most common causes.
Do we know what the cause of Alzheimer's is?
No, we don't know what the cause is, but I mean, pathologically, they can, once the patient's died, they can kind of look at the brain tissue under the microscope and say, hey, this was Alzheimer's because of certain findings they have. But they don't really know the cause of Alzheimer's.
Is there a typical age that one would typically begin to show symptoms?
I think one of the things we also want to differentiate is early onset and then later onset, because oftentimes early onset has a genetic component to it. And there is some research going on at places like Washington University and St. Louis to look at those and define the genetic markers that would define the early onset. Then you have the older adult, and we look at older adults at usually 65 plus, but also the fastest growing population actually in the United States is 85 plus. And so the percentage goes up significantly once we get to 85 plus. So 1 in 2 at 85 plus, or 50%, develop some form of dementia, and then one in six, one in seven nationally, and actually one in six in the state of Louisiana at 65 plus. So age can be a defining factor as far as the development of it, but early onset can be as early as, you know, 50. And
that's related to genetics.
Yes, and that's the smaller percentage. They put the percentage with early onset, the literature, and you all can, if you have other percentages, roughly at 10 to 15% of people with some form of dementia will have that early onset genetic variant.
My guest this evening, Dr. Gary Booker, psychiatrist, also Debbie Hayes, who's with the Louisiana chapter of the Alzheimer's Association the Shreveport area, associate director. Also, Dr. Christine Wright, who's an occupational therapist with LSU Health. And, of course, your calls are welcome this evening. So call us at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. As always, on Health Matters, your comments and questions are welcomed. So what are some of the early signs of Alzheimer's?
I can jump in on that one.
All right.
Of course, as Dr. Booker mentioned, one of the first things you notice is that short-term memory loss. Other things include challenges in planning or solving problems, difficulty completing tasks. I know, like we talked about with my dad, he had a lot of trouble with completing familiar tasks that he once did, changing the oil in the vehicles. You know, he could no longer do that. It was just too complicated for him. Getting confused with time and place, that's always a marker for some people. You know, when you find yourself going to Walmart and you can't find your car, or how did you get there and you can't retrace your steps, things like that. Decreased or poor judgment, making bad decisions, that's frequently a marker for some folks that they didn't have those issues before. Changes in mood or personality, that's another one. Folks find themselves having erratic behavior changes for no apparent reason. So those are just a few of the warning signs.
So early on, would one be likely to just exhibit maybe one or two of the symptoms, and they collectively, as time goes on, more of them occur?
Yeah, some folks may not exhibit some of the warning signs, but typically the first one is the short-term memory loss. But it is a progressive and a consistently progressive problem. So if you just occasionally forget your keys or your wallet, that's not the same as this consistent progressive digression.
Right. Well, because that's what I was going to ask you, because I think at one point or another, we all tend to get forgetful. I certainly forget more now than I used to ages back. But at what point does it become something that really needs to be looked at?
A lot of folks, once they have an issue with that, you know, when it begins to interrupt their daily life, when it begins to interrupt your work, for example, when it becomes a problem and you can't function, those are kinds of big markers that you need to pay attention to. The occasionally forgetting your wallet someplace or your keys, that's not the same as a warning sign for Alzheimer's.
Do you find that, because I'm assuming that initially when you first meet someone who is coming in potentially to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, that it is a family member or a friend that makes the recognition as opposed to the person themselves?
Definitely. We get a lot of calls. In fact, I frequently get calls from neighbors because seniors typically or sometimes live alone. It might be a member of their church family. It might be a member of their family. It might be a next door neighbor who observes these things, because a lot of times the person with the issue may not recognize that they're having a problem. So it's an outsider looking in that can see these changes.
That being the case, how does one, I imagine it's going to be difficult for a family member who's maybe starting to see this and maybe is unsure, but obviously there needs to be some sort of intervention. What do you recommend for people in terms of getting their loved one, you know, convincing them that, well, you know, it's really time to go see someone about this?
We have a lot of times when I do get those calls, we do encourage the involved party to go with them, because a lot of times, like, your loved one isn't going to recognize that they're having issues, that they're asking the same questions, or that they're forgetting things, or they're changing in their behaviors or changing. So it's often You know, we encourage that interested party, that family member, to go with them to the doctor to discuss these changes. Keep a journal of your loved one, or keep a notebook of your friend, and see that the pattern that's developing, is it progressively getting worse? Is it consistent? Those are the kinds of things that you need to take note of and intervene and take that person, go with that person to the doctor.
You're listening to Health Matters this evening on Red River Radio. I'm Kermit Bowling, and my guests include psychiatrist Dr. Gary Booker, also Debbie Hayes with the Louisiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and Dr. Christine Wright. Are there medications that can slow the disease's progress?
At this time, there's really no medications that can slow the diseases. There are a couple of medications that may increase function. In other words, it'll treat some of the symptoms. And I'm sure many of the audience has heard of Aricept and Exelon. That's one group of medicines that's supposed to improve cognition. And it improves it just a small amount. And another drug called Namenda can be added on later in the illness that may also improve the memory. But these drugs don't claim to slow the progression. The rate of decline stays about the same. It's just they function a little higher for that amount of time that they're on the drug. And when I say a little higher, this is based on psychological testing, and often the points are only 3 or 4 points, which may or may not be clinically significant. What I've seen, some patients have zero response to these medications. Very few patients have a fairly good response to it. Most patients, the response is equivocal. You're not really sure if it's helping or not.
Okay, we have actually one question that is coming in online here, and I'll remind you that if you don't want to go on the air, that's fine. You can just let whoever answers the phone for you initially, our screeners, let them know that you have a question that you'd like to have referred into the control room. But if you'd like to call with your question, again, the number is 800-552-8502. And this is a question about another symptom. Does frequent repeating of yourself, is that a warning sign, or is that a different issue?
That tends to be actually kind of a later sign in the disorder. The real problem with this disease is diagnosing it early on. In the last 5 or 10 years, a term called mild cognitive impairment has become real common. And early on, it's real tricky. It's really hard to know then, because they don't meet full criteria for dementia. But often early on, the patient will actually be significantly concerned that the memory is bad. Later on in the illness, it tends to be more the family members know that the memory is not bad. And you have to understand that this memory loss is a pure amnesia. They never recall the event, even after cluing. So they can lose several hours of time. And even somebody says, oh, we were at the movie. It's totally lost memory. It never gets recorded. And the early on memory problems tend to be episodic. They're not constant. They're hard to pin down. The earlier or the fewer the symptoms that the patient has, generally the more thorough the workup has to be. But in the end, often the diagnosis can only be made retrospectively. In other words, after you follow them for 2 or 3 years, you notice this steady decline in memory. So at that point, you have a higher confidence that you got the right diagnosis.
All right. You're listening to Health Matters this evening. The number to call, 800-552-8502. And we'll come back to that in a moment. We do have our first caller. And it says, Stephen from LSU Health Science Center. So I don't know which side it is, if it's University Health or LSU Health. But Stephen, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question this evening. Hello, Stephen. Are you there? Yeah, I guess not. And we seem to have lost that call. Are you the usual the person who diagnoses and tells the person that they have Alzheimer's disease, that tend to be a family physician, or is that usually a psychiatrist?
It can be any of them. It kind of depends on the situation and at the point to where the patient's brought in for medical care. And that varies quite a bit from situation. As a general rule, when I see a patient, more often than not, the pathology's been there for a long time. It's just that the family finally decides they need to do something about it. But the primary care doctor is generally the number one person who makes these diagnoses.
Right.
And that's because there's just more of them. There's more primary care doctors.
When you have a family member that's been diagnosed, obviously you have to learn how to handle that person and respond. And I know, Christine, you actually train people in the medical field on handling this situation. How important is that for everybody at all levels of medical care to understand what's going on?
Oh, it's extremely important. And one of the things I want to talk about is that in 2010, Louisiana passed a law requiring that paid caregivers receive annual training that are in assisted living and long-term care. And Louisiana is one of 39 states currently that have that legislation, and all 50 states will have it, I predict, probably in the next 3 to 5 years. You know, I think we just need to acknowledge that the level of aging that is happening in our country and actually around the world is unprecedented. We've never had people in this number that live this long, and that's just due to medical science and adding longevity to everybody's life, but they're not always living longer well. And so we're going to be seeing more and more people with different dementias. As Dr. Booker said, you know, there are 30 or 40 different types. And so we have to train the caregivers to recognize this, to understand this, and to know what to do. And a lot of what I do, because I'm an occupational therapist, is I train the caregivers to understand how to control the environment in order to help the person with dementia function better. Because a lot of the things that go on in the environment are very confusing to them. And they start, you know, because you also have to realize that general aging is going on. Mm-hmm. So there are things that we lose as we age, like hearing, vision, and then you add dementia on top of that. And so especially with the vision, they have a lot of issues recognizing not only people, but objects and things that are going on around them. And so by training the caregivers about how to set up the environment so it's a positive environment for people with dementia. And of course, I'm a big proponent of memory care units because you can set that up specifically for the residents that are there. And it can be set up so that they live long as well as they can given the disease. Because, you know, the other thing about the disease that we talk about is, you know, there's seven general stages of the disease as people decline, and Dr. Booker alluded to, you know, the initial stages are what preclinical. We the disease has been going on for a long time before we ever really diagnose it, and it's been happening. So it has to get to a certain point where then you have these consistent behaviors. And as you were saying, you know, I forget that I, you know, where my keys are. Well, if you remember that you forgot, probably we're not looking at dementia. It's when right. You forget and can't remember, and that goes on and on and on. And so even if you point out that they forgot, as Dr. Booker said, they're not going to remember that. So it does take a family member or a family of choice member or a community member to go with that person and say, you know, I'm concerned, and so let's just check this out and see what's happening.
So someone that is starting to show these early preclinical symptoms, how long, because you're saying the disease has been active for a while now, what is that typical length of time before we start recognizing it?
It can vary per person. I mean, it could be for years that we have preclinical symptoms, you know, because the other thing to recognize about dementia and Alzheimer's is we're talking about a disease with a pretty long progression for a lot of people. You know, we're talking years, if not decades, that it goes through all of the stages. So, you know, things can be happening in the brain, changes can be happening for quite a long time. And that's what science is trying to do right now, is a lot of the studies that are going on are how to pick this up earlier and trying to find. And so, for instance, Pennington Biomedical Research in Baton Rouge, and and there's a Shreveport arm of this, is looking at healthy people at 60 plus and testing them every year to see if, you know, when those changes occur, that we're trying to decide, you know, where it is between that mild cognitive impairment and actually moving into the pathology of Alzheimer's and dementia. And right now it's very difficult. We don't have really, it's not like we can take a picture of the brain and say, aha, there's the transition. We just aren't able to do that right now. So that's what science is trying to do, so that we have better diagnostic tools to pick it up earlier. But going back to your question, you know, my job is to help practitioners at all levels, and it's really interesting about the law, because it actually requires people even in environmental services, people who answer the phone in long-term care units, CNAs, LPNs, RNs, therapists, activity coordinators, administrators. Everyone has to have some level of training. And I think that's really important, because that means from the time someone walks in the front door to throughout a facility, everybody at least has had basic training about what this disease is, what it looks like, and what are the behaviors that are common to people with Alzheimer's and dementia, so that we separate it from the person is doing this to these behaviors are because of the disease process.
Right. So what you're referring to, of course, is in training the medical community.
Yes.
But what about the person at home who's dealing with their family? Because a lot of it's got to be very, very similar. What resources are available, or how do you help the family member at home? And maybe, Debbie, you're the one to talk about this.
Sure. Right here in our community in the Shreveport-Bossier area, there are a number of programs. I know the Alzheimer's Association's got a lot of online tools, and we also have educational programs. We've had 5 this year. There are other community organizations that provide information, lunch and learn programs and things like that, that are so valuable to the community. Just from a personal experience, I know my father now is 85, but, you know, back when he was diagnosed, he and my mother, none of us knew anything about Alzheimer's, so it's been a real journey to educate us, my mom, the primary caregiver, on how to take care of a person with Alzheimer's as the disease progresses. It's a real struggle, and you talk to a lot of people, and they just don't know what's going on with their loved one. Why is their behavior changing? What's causing these things? It's very traumatic for families.
The number to call to be a part of tonight's Health Matters is 800-552-8502. We are discussing Alzheimer's this evening, and my guests include Dr. Christine Wright, who's an occupational therapist with LSU Health. Also, Debbie Hayes, who you've just heard there a moment ago, Associate Director of the Louisiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. We also have psychiatrist Dr. Gary Booker in with us this evening. Your calls are welcome, again, at 800-552-8502. And again, if you would just like to have your message referred into the control room, that's fine. You don't have to go on the air, although we certainly do welcome your questions and comments. We did have a caller who asked a specific question. They have an 86-year-old grandmother with dementia. Sometimes she is aggressive and harmful to herself. And is there a recommended treatment, perhaps a sedative, for someone like that?
Dr. Booker, in private practice, probably psychiatry comes in most often with Alzheimer's later in the disease, when you do have these organic brain disorders. They have a hard time controlling their behavior. I don't think the patients often are even aware of their behavior. There are special units in town. They're called geriatric psychiatric units, and if you go to one of these, probably at least a third or half of the patients there will be suffering from Alzheimer's. These patients will often wander, and due to their age, they're also fall risk. It's a very difficult group of patients to take care of. There are not any specific FDA-indicated medications for the behavioral disturbance at this point in the disorder. Everything we use is pretty much off-label, and the antipsychotics, which I tend to favor and probably work the best in this group, every single one of them has a black box warning from the FDA about the risk and all in this group, because in the double-blind studies using these drugs to treat this, the Alzheimer's patient on the drug had a lot higher death rate than the patients off of it. So it's an absolute risk. That being said, there's not a whole lot of other options. Some of the trade names that I'll name for the antipsychotics are like Seroquel and Zyprex. So they've been used for a number of years. Some of the older antipsychotics like Haldol, they have been very popular throughout the years. But each one of these drugs has a significant risk of side effects, and it has to be monitored closely. The other drugs are generally the Valium-type drugs, Ativan and Xanax. They tend to add a little bit. And then just about everything else under the sun has been tried, including marijuana and everything else. Nothing really works. You're dealing with organic brain disorder. The brain is very deteriorated. So anything we know about these drugs from younger people where they've been tested and have some type of FDA approved really doesn't apply to the Alzheimer's patient. But that being said, we have nothing else left to use. Behavioral modification, like Christine said, is the structure of an inpatient unit depends so much on the staff, the staffing ratio. It takes a high staffing ratio for these. It often becomes unprofitable to staff them at the ratio that they needed to be staffed at. The ones that stay at home, often the people at home have to hire extra help to help with them. Mm-hmm. And it's a really nasty disorder that lasts two or three years of life.
All right, we do have a caller on hold who's been waiting here. We're going to go to the phones right now, and we have obviously several people who have sent their questions into to the booth. We'll get to those momentarily. But this is James right now. James, thank you so much for holding. Go ahead with your question.
How you doing, sir?
Good.
I was wondering about lifestyle, a more sedentary lifestyle. If somebody's in a rut, doing the same thing every day, not really thinking or reacting very much. Is that more conducive to the onset of Alzheimer's than someone that has more active physical and mentally active lifestyle? And I also heard that one time that metals, like aluminum, could be linked to Alzheimer's also. Is there anything to that?
Who wants to tackle that?
Well, the first question he was asking, one of the things that we do know is that people who engage in always trying to kind of push the limits to what they know, it's not only just a physically active lifestyle, but it's also a mentally challenging lifestyle. So people who travel or learn a new language or even a physical something like learning a ballroom dancing, I talked to a gentleman who's head of the Neuroscience Institute at University of British Columbia, and I asked him, I said, if there was one thing that you would recommend people do to try to hold off dementia for themselves, what would it be? And he said, it's dancing, because it's motor, it's thinking, it's learning new things. But if you do the same thing over and over and over again, the brain, if you're only using like one pattern in your brain, then the brain kind of just loses the rest of the stuff. I mean, we're talking 100 billion brain cells, plus all the connections make about 1 trillion connections in the brain. And if you're only using a small amount, that other stuff just kind of sitting there and waiting for you to
So it really
turn
is
it on
exercising the brain.
It is. It is. But, you know, there's a lot of myth also about, well, if I just do Sudoku puzzles or if I just do crossword puzzles, I'll hold it off. Well, the problem with puzzles and some of those things is if you do them long enough, you actually memorize how to do them. So then the brain is not challenged anymore. So the puzzles are good to a point, but you need to do other things. You need to get out there. And the other thing we know about just older adults in general is the larger social circle they have, the better they age, period. So if people, you know, making friends, going out and trying new things, going out and a church, new church group or a new social group is really important to keeping the brain healthy.
We do have a question that came in that really does relate to what you're talking about here. The caller says that her older brother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and the doctor says to take him home and, quote, keep him busy. And that is the question. So what are some of the activities? You mentioned dancing, but are there others that you might recommend?
Yes, there are. And one of the things I would, and Dr. Booker started talking about this, but when people actually have the diagnosis and their disease has progressed enough, routine is really important. You know, when we look at aggressive behaviors, usually it's one of two things. One, their routine was disrupted by something, or two, they were overstimulated by sensory, too much television, too much noise going on. I mean, there are environmental things that we can control. So by keep the daily routines, like when we get up, when we get dressed, when we have breakfast, a lot of times when it's consistent, then people recognize that and are comfortable with that and don't get very upset. But it's when even going to a doctor's appointment can be upsetting because that's not a typical thing they do every day. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, just fidgeting kind of things to keep people busy is not enough. We have to come up with things, and also things that are meaningful. You know, you have to also understand that they may be 65 years of age, but in their mind they're 24. So they may start talking about things that they really enjoyed when they were younger. So those are the things that we need to engage them in and figure out where they are in their mind and choose those things. It may seem, you know, as the disease progresses, people may say, well, that's really infantile, for example, if they carry around a baby doll. But if in their mind they're at that age where they had children, it's not infantile because they really do believe that the baby is theirs. So we have family members become great detectives about what's going on in the environment and where that person is in their mind. And so does staff. And it is true that high quality staffing is really important, which is why the training is so important, so that we recognize these things and are able to carry those out. And it does become individualized care at that point, because not everybody likes bingo. Not everybody likes puzzles. Sure. So we have to figure out what they like and try to engage them in that. Yeah.
That makes sense. The number to call tonight so you can participate in tonight's Health Matters, 1-800-552-8502. And that is 800-552-8502. We are discussing Alzheimer's, and my guests are Dr. Gary Booker, also Dr. Christine Wright and Debbie Hayes. And we'd love to hear from you this evening. Another caller wants to know if there's a way who someone who might be younger to get involved with Alzheimer's studies in order to advance the research. And in addition to that, I might ask the question, what research is going on at this point? What hope do we have, and what new directions are the research scientists taking us?
I'm going to jump in on that one.
Sure.
There are a couple of tools out there to learn about clinical trials going on. In Louisiana alone, I think there are a number of areas. Dr. Booker has done research and is very active in this area with them. Drug trials, Lake Charles Clinical Trials is another facility that has clinical trials going on. Dr. Patterson, when he was at LSU, had clinical trials going on. There are a number, and you can find those. One of the programs that the Alzheimer's Association has, it's called Trial Match, and you can simply fill out a profile, and we will help you locate and match you with the program that is suited for your particular situation, whether you're a healthy individual who just wants to help and be involved in clinical trials, because we still need healthy individuals as well in any clinical trial. You know, they have to have a baseline, mm-hmm. a healthy population, so healthy folks are definitely needed for clinical trials, but our program is Trial Match. But then there is, I forgot, what's the government one? You can go to, I think, clinicaltrials.gov, something as simple as that, and it's a database listing as well. But we can help you if you just fill out a profile and get you linked with a clinical trial nearest you that meets your situation.
So what are some of the research projects that are going on?
This is Dr. Booker. The research projects I have right now, one of them is a monoamine oxidase, a drug that may help treat symptoms, kind of like Aricept and Namenda. It's looking at a moderate degree of Alzheimer's. And the other one, more interesting, is a monoclonal antibody that's infused that actually removes the amyloid from the brain. And it does remove the amyloid. We don't know yet if it treats Alzheimer's, and that's the purpose of the study.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long-term study, and it's looking at, instead of treating the symptoms, working on slowing the rate of decline. And I'm currently recruiting for those two studies. I'm not trying to advertise per se. But there's other things going on all over the country. This MCI, a lot of studies there are not necessarily looking at treatment. They're just looking at following the patient longitudinally to see if they actually do develop Alzheimer's. When it really comes down to it, we're pretty weak on our rate of decline and the natural history of Alzheimer's. We have a general idea, but when we try to go in there and plug in numbers, they vary quite a bit. And part of that's because every individual seems to have a different rate of decline. And there's definitely at least two types of Alzheimer's. There's probably more. And there is that younger type that tends to be a lot more genetically linked. And the older type, I've heard numbers that like at 85, at least 40% of the people have Alzheimer's disease. And so there's a lot of it out there at old age. But a lot of the old age Alzheimer's doesn't seem to be as aggressive as the young age. Some of this young age Alzheimer's, say in the early 60s or 65, in a matter of 3 years, they can be bedridden. Mm-hmm. After the diagnosis is made. There's a lot of epidemiological research that needs to be done. And of course, there's a lot of pharmacological research sponsored by the drug companies, which is some of the stuff I participate in.
We have a little less than 20 minutes to go in tonight's Health Matters. So if you want to participate, if you'd have a question for one of our guests, or perhaps a comment relating to your own experience, maybe with a loved one, give us a call at 800-552-8502. Again, the number is 1-800-552-8502. At what stage in the progression of the disease is it usually recommended for families to move away from caring for the loved one at home and moving them into a facility? And then beyond that, what do people look for in a facility and in or for that matter, for perhaps extra help caregivers at home?
I'll start with that one.
Sure.
From personal experience, I know the family generally decided early on after my dad had his diagnosis that, you know, it was our goal to keep our father at home as long as possible. But for every family facing Alzheimer's, it is certainly a unique and an individual decision. Some families don't have the resources, either financial resources or support structure, to keep their loved one at home. Some of those environments aren't suitable for a person to stay at home. But for us, our decision, and again, it was just a personal decision for our unique situation, was to keep him at home as long as possible. If you choose that path, just from personal experience, I can tell you, you're sort of on a one-way train then, and you're going to stay on that train until a certain point where he is wandering. He is up all night. He is not eating. His sleeping patterns are all mixed up. Then it becomes very hard for the spouse, the caregiver, to maintain any kind of a normal life, a healthy life. Frequently, mm-hmm. the caregiver will pass away before the person with Alzheimer's due to the stress, due to the all of those things going on impacting their life. So, you know, once we got on that path, we were pretty much bound to that. And so when he did start exhibiting those things, the wandering, couldn't keep him in the yard, couldn't keep him in the house, couldn't keep him asleep at night, he wasn't eating, that was the time that we knew we just couldn't go any farther at home. But again, it's a very unique, very individual decision. A lot of people want to make the transition earlier. It might be easier for those families then, while they're still functioning well enough that they can absorb the change and the transition isn't that traumatic. Mm-hmm. For my dad, the transition was quite traumatic because, as Dr. Christine here had said, that you know, they get used to that pattern. He was used to being at home, and so his transition was probably a little bit more difficult. He was advanced in the disease, and so it was very dramatic, very traumatic for him to go to a facility. You know, so you just have to weigh the pros and cons. Are you going to keep him at home? Can you keep him at home versus moving early to a facility or to get outside help?
And I agree with that, because one of the things we often see, just as you're talking, is that the spouse, of course, is around the same age as the person who has the disease. And they're oftentimes, because they are so engaged with caregiving, you know, they ignore a lot of their own health needs and things. And we have spouses that will die right before the other person or very shortly thereafter. And a wise person once said, you can't give what you don't have. So I think one of the things is for also the caregiver to kind of monitor their needs, because you're right, the sleeping patterns ultimately flip, where they want to be up at night and sleep during the day. And if even a caregiver is still working or needs to work because of finances, you know, it takes a lot. And I read a statistic there, roughly maybe 100,000, I think the last one I read from the state of Louisiana, there are 100,000 people with dementia currently in the state, and there's 150,000 caregivers. So you're talking almost 2-to-1 at that point. I actually had one of my students, we were talking about this and saying that it took 3 people at night with her grandfather to be able to keep everybody safe. And so it requires a lot of assistance, especially once the sleep patterns flip. So it is individual. Again, when they're functioning better, though, a lot of times they do better with the transition, because they're a little more flexible to changes in their routine and later on. So that may be something to consider for individuals. But it is, you know, it is expensive at places, and that is always something that people have to take into account, their finances.
Right. Well, familiarity and routine are helpful in this. And, of mm-hmm. course, you have someone that is losing their memory. What can be done? Are there any things that someone can do for their loved one to help prolong the memory, the recognition of the family, and all of that as long as possible?
I want to go back to some of the prevented stuff we talked about
sure.
earlier. We have to be real careful there, because the Alzheimer's patient may be the one who doesn't want to go outside. So there may be a lot of bias in the statistics or the idea of what slows the disease. The active person who doesn't have Alzheimer's, he keeps going. He can say, well, I accomplished this because I stayed active. Well, he never was going to get Alzheimer's in the first place. Whereas the Alzheimer's patient just kind of dwindled into the background, was perfectly content reading the same book every day. And to my knowledge, there's not a whole lot that slows or prevents the disease. It makes good sense, obviously, to keep anybody as active as possible. But the pathology here is very hard pathology, and there's not a lot you can do about it.
Okay. I have two questions that have come in from callers that had them referred to the control room. So the first one is a true or false question, and this relates to the activities that we were talking about and the types of activities. True or false, reading, playing cards are activities that are useful in preventing or prohibiting Alzheimer's?
Again, as Dr. Booker just alluded to, and as we've talked about, you're not going to be able to eat blueberries to prevent Alzheimer's. There's not going to be one key that's going to do that. But I think just about all of us would agree, though, that, you know, healthy lifestyle, staying active, all of those things are great behaviors to maintain good quality of health, which might, in some cases, delay some onset. It's never a bad idea to have a good health regimen, a good exercise regimen, a good, you know, so those kinds of things are always helpful.
The number to call to participate in tonight's Health Matters, 1-800-552-8502, with just about 10 minutes to go here. If you have had a question you've been waiting to call, give us a call now, 800-552-8502. This next caller wants to know, and this gets back to the genetic progression of Alzheimer's. Is there any pattern? Is it generally passed to a son or to a daughter or both, or is there no difference? And what about skipping a generation?
The current research, there is nothing about passing it on to a son or daughter as far as other types of diseases, that it's an X or Y chromosome type of disease. It's not that. Right now, the latest research, there's six markers that they've identified, different markers that can contribute to this early onset. I mean, how many markers you have, and again, depending on the progression. So it's that's the genetic component. But as far as passing it along, there's no evidence right now that says, okay, it's definitely going to go from father to son. It doesn't work like that. But I mean, they have, the reason that they learn about the genetic component is they have families come in where like 9 out of 10 children have early onset. Mm. So they look at the markers, then they look at, you know, grandma, aunt, you know, grandpa, all these different people. So as far as skipping a generation, I can't answer that. But that's how we really find it, is when we get families that have several children or whatever that have developed the early onset form of the Alzheimer's. But it's not like other diseases that are transmitted father to son or mother to son. It's a different, just different thing.
I think statistically right now I've read that there are more women affected by Alzheimer's, but that has nothing to do with the chromosome issue.
Right.
There are more women who live longer, for one thing, and it affects women at a greater rate because they're primarily the caregivers. So, you know, Alzheimer's impacts women at a greater rate, but that's just happenstance.
Right.
Sure. Debbie, you referred earlier in one of your answers to the cost, in terms of financial cost, of caring for someone. Can you talk a little bit about what those costs are? And for a lot of them, I'm sure, are expensive. And for a family that doesn't have a lot of resources, you know, what opportunities do they have for help?
Oh, my goodness. I think on a wide scale, I think it costs something like $200 billion a year to care for the 5 million people with Alzheimer's. Right. So it's quite expensive. And I think Dr. Booker had mentioned that, you know, in the later stages of the patient's life, it's extremely expensive. I think most of, like for my dad, for example, in my whole lifetime, my father had only been to the hospital twice, and now he's been 3 times this summer. So, you know, as that patient is aging, as they're dealing with Alzheimer's in the later stages, there are just so many more hospital trips. The medicine is expensive, and you know, families may have long-term care insurance. Some don't. Most don't. And even with long-term care insurance, it just kind of depends on the policy as to how much it pays for. My mom's only covers half of the cost for my dad to be in a facility. You know, you've just got a world of issues. The smallest things, the medicines, the supplies he uses, all of those things are being billed to you, and you just have no idea until you see that statement what's on there, that how quickly that adds up.
And, of course, you're with the Alzheimer's Association, and this might be a good time to talk about the resources that are available through the association.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Like I said, we have a wealth of information on the website, alz.org. I know a lot of people in the rural areas in Louisiana don't have access to the Internet, and we totally understand that. You can give us a call. We partner with a lot of area agencies and facilities here in town. Can provide referrals, doctor referral lists, facility referral lists, even support groups in the area. There are some, probably more than half a dozen support groups in the area. We also have a 1-800 support group, so if a family member can't get out of the house, they can join a support group over the phone. We've got a lot of information that you can either contact me at the local office or give our 24/7 helpline a call. It's 1-800-272-3900, and that's my commercial for the evening.
You want to mention the walk to ends Alzheimer's while we're on?
Oh, yeah.
You might
as well, because while I'm still on my commercial. Yeah, I appreciate you having us and discussing Alzheimer's, but we are having a walk event this Saturday. It is at the Louisiana Boardwalk. It starts at 9 a.m. There's no registration fee, and truly, if you just want to come out and learn more about Alzheimer's, show that you support the vision of a world with no Alzheimer's, and just come out and meet people that are struggling and connect with people. It's a great way for families to feel like they're not alone in this dreadful disease.
And I know that there are other similar events going on in other cities in our area. For example, San Augustine, Texas has one in November. And you can, of course, find out more information about all of those as well, I think, at the website, alz.org.
Yes. Yes.
All right. The number to call, 1-800-552-8502, if you'd like to get in a question for our panel tonight on tonight's Health Matters discussing Alzheimer's. One thing that we started touching on and didn't quite get back to is in finding that caregiver or finding the facility, what should a person be looking for specifically? What questions should they ask?
When we shopped, one thing that my mom was the primary caregiver, and of course she's elderly, so location of the facility, is it somewhere convenient? Do you plan on visiting? What kind of training are they, the staff members, have they received? Check on their recurring training. Are they up to date? Do they know how to handle Alzheimer's? Look at the staff-patient ratio. How large is the facility? Those kinds of things. Do you have access to your loved one anytime? What kind of a protocol do they have for notifying the family if something goes wrong? What kind of protocol do they have for doctor's visits? Do you have to use their doctor? Do they have a doctor at the facility? You know, transportation for your loved one if they do need to go to the doctor, is that provided, not provided? The cost factor, you know, how is that going to be billed out? There are just so many things to think about when you're looking for a location. But like I always tell somebody, you can't do this over the phone. You've got to go visit a facility, meet the people, meet the staff. Go at different times during the day, morning, evening, night, see how they're treating other patients. See, is your loved one going to be in a memory care unit? Are they going to be in general population? It's just a lot of things to learn about the facility that you're interested in.
Okay, we're referring to memory care unit. We're just talking about an area of the facility just for patients with various dementias?
That's correct. It can be a facility dedicated, or it can be a part of a facility dedicated to it, but it is for specifically dedicated to those who have some form of dementia, and it's often the ones that I see a smaller number of beds, maybe 10, 12 beds rather than hundreds or, you know, in a facility. It's often, it's not always a locked unit, but it's off sometimes off to one side, or it can be, there's a facility in town where they have separate cottages. I mean, it's just a totally different place than the regular, long-term care facility, and the staff are often trained specifically to work with this particular population. And so okay. that's maybe something that people also want to look into, is it, you know, if they want that kind of care.
Okay, we have two callers on hold here. We're going to try to get to both of you here, but we only have about 4 minutes or so. So, Jeremiah, you've been waiting for your question. Go ahead.
Yeah, recently in the news, there's been some research that talks about peanut butter and that being used to diagnose people with Alzheimer's. I was just wondering if there was any validity to that, and is there any link between olfactory senses and peanut butter? And Alzheimer's, I'm sorry.
I'll make a stab at that. I'm going to say 15 years ago, they actually had a little smell test. The olfactory area of the brain where you recognize smells has been written in the literature to be lost early in Alzheimer's. In my patients, I've never been convinced if that's totally true or not, but I'm assuming with the peanut butter, if they can taste the peanut butter, they can recognize the peanut butter. If they can't, you know, I mean, most of your taste is in the olfactory. And if they can't recognize it, that would be an indication that part of their memory is going, at least the memory of smell. So there's probably some validity to it. I wouldn't go out and buy stock in it.
We have one last question tonight from Emily. Thank you for holding. I hope you're still there. I hear clicks. Emily, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay. My question is what is the correlation with having shingles and suddenly developing or having a diagnosis of Alzheimer's? Okay. I've had two family members that have been involved in this. One is a blood relative, and the other one is not.
Okay.
I'll make a stab at that. Obviously, shingles is a central nervous system disease. I don't know if there is any relationship, but I think it's an interesting concept, and it would be interesting to. I would have to review the literature to see if there is any type of correlation. I doubt it, but there may be some weak correlation. It is an interesting concept.
There was an earlier question too from one of our callers. I don't think we got to that either, about the aluminum, about metals.
The aluminum hypothesis. I remember reading about that. I think in 1985. It was like my first Alzheimer's article. I got it read. And it was based on some Canadian people that worked in aluminum mines. They had more dementia. But I think as over the years, that hypothesis has been eliminated as false.
All right. And we're coming close to the end of the program here. My guests have been Dr. Gary Booker, a psychiatrist here in the Shreveport area. Also, Debbie Hayes, Associate Director of the Louisiana Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Also, Dr. Christine Wright, who's an occupational therapist with LSU Health, specializes in training medical personnel and families also on how to care for those with Alzheimer's. And we have just about 1 minute. So in 1 minute's time on a very, very broad and difficult subject, any recommendations that you might have if someone is generally thinking that they might have a member of their family who may be suffering with this disease?
My first thought would be don't wait. Talk to your doctor about it. If you have any inclination or any thought that you're having issues, to talk to a professional about your concerns.
I agree. Sooner rather than later, so we can get a plan in place for them.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for being a part of this evening's show. As always, Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a health professional. The show will be available for download later this evening, hopefully, from redriverradio.org. If not, it'll be tomorrow. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Wally Derleth, Iman Bader, and Daniel Gordy. Support from this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Kermit Bowling. Thank you all for joining us this evening.